Welcome to the 32nd episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Boston, Massachusetts for a State of the Science Summit on ovarian cancer and soft tissue sarcoma. During the meeting, faculty from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute gave focused presentations on the facets of genetic testing in ovarian cancer, surgical options available for patients with a newly diagnosed disease, and emerging strategies for the treatment of patients with uterine sarcomas. Additional topics included novel strategies and emerging agents being used in the treatment of patients with recurrent ovarian cancer, the success of PARP inhibitors in the relapse setting, and the use of immunotherapy combinations in gynecologic cancers. Prior to the start of the summit, we sat down with Joyce F. Liu, MD, MPH, chair of the meeting, who serves as the Director of Clinical Research in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology and an Assistant Professor of Medicine at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Liu explained that with the emergence of new frontline regimens in ovarian cancer, the key for future research is for broader groups of patients to benefit and eventually achieve cures with systemic therapies. In our interview, Liu shared key considerations to remember in the newly diagnosed ovarian cancer space and the use of PARP inhibitors in the frontline maintenance setting.
So maintenance PARP inhibitors are something that we've really looked at in the recurrent setting, platinum sensitive setting. These are approved now. They've definitely shown benefit across all women with ovarian cancer, where the effect is most pronounced in women with BRCA mutated ovarian cancer. But we've seen increased progression-free survival in all women who have platinum sensitive disease, who have responded to platinum chemotherapy. In the upfront setting, right now we only have one study that's given us results. That's the SOLO-1 study. And in that, this was presented in October of this year in ESMO. It was at the same time published in the New England Journal of Medicine. We saw a very profound progression-free survival benefit with women with BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer going on a maintenance PARP inhibitor. That maintenance PARP inhibitor was olaparib. Interestingly, the study truncated olaparib treatment at 2 years, unless patients still had evidence of active disease. But that benefit looks like it may be persisting. One thing to know about the SOLO-1 study, I think, is that we do have to wait for those data to mature more. I think while we followed them and we see the 3-year landmark studies show that the number of women who have not progressed is almost 60%, we have to follow that further in time. One thing that's very intriguing is whether or not we could be actually not just prolonging time to recurrence, but maybe we could be curing some of those women. That would make a huge impact on overall survival, but we don't know those data yet. The data are not yet ready for us.
Next, we sat down with Huma Q. Rana, MD, Clinical Director of Cancer Genetics and Prevention at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. She highlighted the benefits of genetic testing in gynecologic oncology. According to Rana, testing can inform individual and familial risk of developing a malignancy, alert patients to possible screening and preventative measures, and guide treatment with targeted therapies.
Universally, genetic testing is recommended for women with a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, and there's no question about that. It's very clear that women with this diagnosis have a high prevalence of germline or inherited mutations. There's no question that that information can help both them in their treatment of their ovarian cancer, but also be really helpful for their family members in being screened for related cancers, other component tumors, or to help prevent ovarian cancer. And so we all know that this testing should be happening universally. I think that we also recognize that there are limitations to making it happen.
There are two potential treatment approaches for patients with newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer. Neil Horowitz, MD, told us in our interview at the summit. Horowitz, Director of Clinical Research in Gynecologic Oncology, Associate Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecologic and Reproductive Biology at Harvard Medical School and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, highlighted surgical approaches for patients with newly diagnosed disease.
Again, I think trying to decide which women should have primary site reductive surgery is a challenge. Right now, there are no standard, uniformly accepted predictive models, either whether it's radiographic, CA125s, values. I think there are certain disease locations that can be determined by imaging that are no-fly zones, where you just wouldn't try to operate to remove those. But outside of those areas, I think that it really comes down to a surgeon's sort of preference for how they approach patients, their willingness to push the envelope and be aggressive to remove the disease that's there, which really is reflective of their training, the support that they have in their institution to do those aggressive surgical procedures, the ancillary support to help get their patients through whatever may happen. So I do think that it's an individualized, both for the patient and the surgeon, choice about how to approach this disease surgically. You know, essentially the idea is that with less disease there at the start of the chemotherapy, there are less cells that may be around to become resistant to the chemotherapy that it's exposed to. So it's, I think, simply just a matter of volume of disease and the time of exposure to the chemotherapy. And then hopefully that with the surgery, you're removing cells that may have inherent disease resistance, and at the same time, removing cells that would ultimately develop drug resistance over prolonged or repetitive exposure to the drug. So I think there are two possible ways that the site reduction may help.
Next, we sat down with Suzanne George, MD, Director of Clinical Research in the Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, who explained that while chemotherapeutic approaches are available for patients with uterine sarcomas, research is moving in the direction of novel combinations, biomarkers, and collaboration. In our interview, George highlighted the current state of uterine sarcoma management, highlighted available options, and progress made in identifying biomarkers.
I was very appreciative to be invited to participate in this talk tonight, in the program tonight. I know that it's primarily a GYN oncology talk and program, and as you know, I'll be speaking about sarcomas of the uterus. And, you know, uterine sarcomas are uncommon. They represent collectively 3% or less of all uterine cancers. And uterine mesenchymal malignancies are challenging because it's a group of diseases. Leiomyosarcoma is only one of the subtypes of uterine sarcomas. And so for women who are diagnosed with these rare tumors, they can enter the health system in so many different ways. They can enter in through GYN, through GYN oncology, through medical oncology that's part of GYN, through a soft tissue sarcoma medical oncologist that's not part of GYN. And so we have this group of women that have rare diseases that's care can be fragmented because they can enter the system in so many different ways. And I really think that as a field, there's a tremendous opportunity for collaboration between GYN oncology and sarcoma medical oncology, really to build bridges around what we understand, around what we need to learn, so that we can come together as a community fundamentally with the patients at the center. And so I really just am very appreciative of the organizers for including a soft tissue sarcoma element in the program tonight. So I just really want to say thank you to that. So that's one thing that I think is very important. I think other things with regard to this, to the treatment therapies that we have, recent studies have suggested that gemcitabine and docetaxel-based regimens, as well as anthracycline-based regimens, both have activity in this disease. And I really think it's not about which one is better per se, but really, again, for women to know that there are multiple options available to them. With the advent of olaratumab, which is a novel Peter Jeffrey receptor alpha antibody, which was approved over the last couple of years in both the U.S. and in Europe, I think it again really highlights the importance of collaboration and communication in this field. Olaratumab, when used with doxorubicin,
demonstrated an overall survival advantage when compared to doxorubicin alone when looked at in patients with metastatic soft tissue sarcoma, including leiomyosarcoma. This improvement in overall survival led to the approval and the commercial availability of the drug, but also came with the requirement of a confirmatory phase 3 trial, which is currently underway. The study has completed its accrual, and what we're doing now is just waiting for the readout, something that we'll really be looking forward to. Olaratumab is also being studied in combination with other chemotherapies, again, just to see exactly how we're going to use this agent in soft tissue sarcoma in general, but also in the subset of women with uterine sarcomas.
Ursula A. Matalonis, MD, explained how physicians are beginning to consider recurrent ovarian cancer differently in terms of emerging therapeutic strategies, a refined focus on disease histology, and re-examining the definition of platinum resistance. In our interview, Matt Alonis, chief of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, shed light on the recurrent ovarian cancer setting and discussed data regarding the addition of bevacizumab to standard chemotherapy.
So the data I'm going to present, and I was asked to present, is on the use of bevacizumab in recurrence. So I am presenting data adding bevacizumab to standard chemotherapy, so either carboplatin gemcitabine or carboplatin pegylated liposomal doxorubicin for recurrent platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer. There's a trial recently presented at ESMO that looked at carbo-gem-bev versus liposomal doxorubicin and bevacizumab, and some of those results. And then, you know, it's kind of reiterating older results, the Aurelia trial, looking at the addition of Bev to non-platinum-based chemotherapy for platinum-resistant cancer. Again, this is not new data at all. I think we're thinking about recurrent ovarian cancer a little bit differently. You know, we've typically thought about platinum resistance as being, you know, having a platinum-free interval of less than 6 months and platinum sensitivity more than 6 months. But I think our paradigm is changing, thinking about patients who are appropriate for platinum and maybe not appropriate for platinum. I guess those definitions are probably going to be seeping into our clinical trial eligibility, but they haven't quite been defined that way yet. But I think it's a good way of thinking about it, just because there are patients who may be defined as platinum resistant in the true sense of kind of how the definition had been previously, who are really going to have platinum sensitive disease, especially as we define recurrence based upon CA125 rise, where that may be, you know, premature in calling somebody platinum resistant.
Next, we spoke with Susana Campos, MD, MPH, who said that with 3 PARP inhibitors available for patients with recurrent ovarian cancer and in the maintenance setting, ongoing trials will answer questions about where the future management of the disease will look like. In our interview, Campos, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, highlighted how PARP inhibitors have impacted the ovarian cancer space and discuss the practice-changing findings from the SOLO-1 trial.
I mean, the SOLO-1 trial was specifically a BRCA mutation carrier state. And so patients in the upfront setting, after they finished their chemotherapy, if they were in a complete remission, they were subsequently randomized to an intervention, which in this case was olaparib or placebo. And they were followed. And they were on treatment for about 2 years. And in a landmark analysis of about 3 years, it was striking because the patients that were randomized to the olaparib, about 60-some-odd% were progression-free at that time as opposed to about 24%. This is statistically significant. Where this pans out in the future, does it improve overall survival? Too early to tell. These are not mature results. But at least at first blush, I mean, these are incredibly exciting data. I mean, I think anyone who's in the room understands and gets a chill when they actually see that data, yeah.
For our last interview, we sat down with Panagiotis A. Constantinopoulos, MD, Director of Translational Research, Gynecologic Oncology at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He discussed the status of immunotherapy in ovarian cancer and focused on several combinations under investigation.
Besides cervical cancer and uterine cancer. In ovarian cancer, we still don't have any FDA-approved indication for immunotherapy. Having said that, we always have to remember that if a tumor is microsatellite unstable, we can still use pembrolizumab. And I'm saying that because although if you look at high-grade serous ovarian cancer, the incidence of microsatellite instability is very, very low. It's about 1 to 2%. There are certain subtypes of ovarian cancer, for example, the low-grade endometrioid subtype, where we can see microsatellite instability. Interestingly, I want to mention here, clear cell ovarian cancer, which is a very aggressive and unique subtype of ovarian cancer, in a study that we did in our institution, we looked at 30 clear cell tumors. We found that three of them were microsatellite unstable, and they actually had the clinical characteristics of tumors that are microsatellite unstable. So they had high tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, they had high PD-L1 expression. So I think it's interesting, and I think it's worth when you're dealing with a clear cell ovarian cancer to send a microsatellite instability testing either by immunohistochemistry, because even if it's going to be very rare, even if it's 5 or 10%, 10% in our study, again, small numbers. These are tumors that are very difficult to treat, and if we find that they are microsatellite unstable, then we can offer these patients meaningful responses with immunotherapy. So switching gears now to ovarian cancer. And as I said, unfortunately, there is no FDA-approved indication for immunotherapy. And there have been a number of studies, and I think the state of the art in 2018 is that we can safely say that single-agent immunotherapy does not work in ovarian cancer, unfortunately, except, as I said, for the microsatellite unstable, which is rare. So there have been a number of studies, the nivolumab study, which I'm going to discuss, published in JCO 2015, 20 patients. Response rate there was 15%, three responses among 20 patients. Again, small study, all platinum resistant. There was no association between PD-L1 positive and PD-L1 negative tumors. Interestingly, among those 20 patients, there were two clear cells. One of them responded. So again, these clear cells may have a unique, we don't know whether these tumors were microsatellite unstable, but the one out of two responded. So 15% with nivolumab, again, a small study. With avelumab, which is a PD-L1 antibody, we have a larger study, which was presented at ASCO 2016, 124 patients. Response rate there was 9.7%. So again, modest response. There was a trend that tumors that had PD-L1 positive, the response rate was 12%, around 12%. With PD-L1 negative tumors, the response was only 6%. So there seems to be a little bit higher response rate with PD-L1 positivity. Again, the cutoff there was 1% cutoff. But again, modest responses. And finally, we have the pembrolizumab data that Dr. Maciulloni has presented at the ASCO Keynote 100 study. This study showed across the board an objective response rate of 8%. Interestingly, if you look at the tumors that had a CPS score, a combined proportionality score, again, this is both the tumor cells and the immune cells expression of PD-L1 that had more a CPS score of at least 10, the response rate was 17%, which is an interesting finding. So potentially for really tumors that have very high scores, but these are not common, pembrolizumab by itself could have activity. But still, we can safely say that single-agent immunotherapy has only modest activity. So there's been a lot of effort of trying to build on combinations. And I'm going to discuss today a number of combinations. I think there have been combinations with cytotoxic therapy, like Doxil, the Javelin study with avelumab. There have been combinations with anti-angiogenic therapy, like nivolumab, bevacizumab, a study that Dr. Liu presented at ESMO. And there have been a lot of excitement of combinations of PARP inhibitors with immunotherapy. There are two studies, one that I presented, the Topacio study at ASCO 2018, and also the Mediola study of olaparib plus durvalumab. These studies were done in a completely different patient population. The Topacio study was done in platinum-resistant, mostly BRCA wild-type, HRD-negative HR-positive patients, while the Mediola study was in a very HR-deficient patient population, patients who were BRCA-mutated and also platinum-sensitive. And I think that overall, we cannot say that one or the other combination is best, that we don't have comparisons between those combinations. But I think that we're seeing that all of these approaches seem to improve the response rate compared to what we see with single agent. But I think that we still have a long way to go to identify the right combination. I think that combinations with PARP inhibitors are exciting. I think the combinations with anti-angiogenic therapy is also very exciting. We still have to see what's going to happen with more cytotoxic therapies as they are being combined with chemotherapy, with immunotherapy.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 32nd episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to hear more about the treatment landscape of gastrointestinal malignancies, consider registering for the March 14th State of the Science Summit in Charlotte, North Carolina. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on March 26th in New York, which will focus on the latest progress made in ovarian cancer and soft tissue sarcoma. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.